Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 200. And thank you guys for watching. Thank you guys for listening. As I was preparing, if you watched my last podcast, you know where we ended there. Told you we were going to pick up talking about the exact same thing that we were talking about in the last podcast. I had hoped that we would finish talking about this topic today. And as I was preparing for this podcast, I realized that I'm probably not going to be finished talking about this topic today. We'll probably have to pick it up again on Monday, and we'll see how it goes. As I was researching for this podcast and putting things together, picking up from the last podcast, and I do recommend you go back and watch that if you haven't, is that there's still a lot here. There's still a lot here. And the issue that we are talking about, essentially, we've been talking about this issue for a few weeks now, is this issue of the war in Ukraine, the proxy war between our war with Russia. And I was explaining to you and have been explaining to you in detail how this war began, our involvement, what happened in Ukraine, how we meddled in Ukraine. And I was explaining the larger picture of what this war is about, first from the Russian point of view. And I explained that this is no less than a holy war for the Russians, is what they say. This comes from the Russian Orthodox patriarch, that he has classified this as a holy war. That's the way they view it. I've been talking, this last podcast, the beginning of last podcast was about, and then today and Monday are going to be about, I'm going to talk about what's going on our side. How are we viewing this war? What this war is really about from the United States point of view. And when I say from the United States point of view, I'm not talking about the United States people. The people of the United States don't matter. It's the people in Washington and the people in New York, as you're going to see today, that are important, and what they want and how they view the war in Russia, or the war in Ukraine and our proxy war with Russia. So I have a lot to share, so let's not waste any time and get right into this. So it looks like the $60 billion package for aid to Ukraine is getting ready to be brought to the fore for a vote by Mike Johnson. Now, Mike Johnson, he has a lot of pressure on him because Republican voters, largely, and this is something very new in the Republican Party. For years and years, the Republican Party has been the hawkish party. The war propaganda was more effective on conservative and Republican voters than Democrat voters. Now that has flipped. The people who are more susceptible to war propaganda and the most effective weapon in war is the propaganda. Those people are in the Democratic Party now. So Mike Johnson, being a Republican speaker, is under a lot of pressure because for a large majority of Republican voters don't want a single dime more to be going to Ukraine. No more money to Ukraine, no matter what. And Johnson is being pulled by the war hawks, some within his own party, as you're going to see, and largely from the Democratic Party and the Democratic president of the United States. And because the Democratic Party is the war party now, they're the ones who are pushing the war. So there's a lot of pressure on him to pass this deal. And from what I understand, you know, they already passed it in the Senate, but what he's doing is that he's, you know, working on a new bill that includes the package that was passed in the Senate. And also some border stuff to appease the Republican voters that don't want another dime to go to Ukraine. Marjorie. Sorry about that. Marjorie Taylor Greene has said, has threatened that if you do this, and that, and she has a lot of support too, that if you do this, then we're going to vacate your seat. That's what she said, is the threat that she's made. And it is, it's really interesting what's going on, because there's a derogatory term that that is associated with Republicans that are peace Republicans that don't want any of our money going to any of these foreign wars, and want to focus on our debt and making America better. And it, the term is isolationist. You know, they have a crafty term for everyone, and you know, give you an example. So if you didn't think that the COVID-19 vaccine was safe, and you didn't, they called you an anti-vaxxer, or if you didn't completely buy the 9/11 story the way they told you, you were called a truther, which I never really understand, because you wanted the truth about 9/11, but that's the derogatory term that they associated with everyone who was asking questions about 9/11. You were a truther. This started with the Kennedy assassination. They created the term conspiracy theorist specifically for people who did not believe that the Kennedy assassination was on the up and up. If you don't believe that the election was fair in 2020, you're an election denier. So for Republicans, for this new, well, it's not new. I mean, you've always had a small minority of what they call isolationists in the Republican Party, but the isolationists have, they've taken over the Republican Party. People like me. Yes, I'm absolutely an isolationist. You want to know who else was an isolationist? George Washington was an isolationist. Much like we were looking at the farewell address, the televised farewell address that Eisenhower did in 1961, George Washington actually wrote out a farewell address where he says that we have a luxury of having the Atlantic Ocean separating us from Europe. That don't get involved in all of these wars and everything in Europe. Let them stay over there. Let them do that. This is George Washington. He was an isolationist. he actually fought in the First World War. The First World War is not the First World War that you're thinking of. George Washington fought in the real First World War, the Seven Years War. So he understood war. He understood the conflicts of Europe, and said, look, we have this huge Atlantic Ocean between us. Let's take advantage of that. Let's stay out of that mess. So he was an isolationist. So yes, these are all banners that I wear very proudly. Isolationist, truther, conspiracy theorist. What did they call the vaccine people? Vaccine denier, or whatever they call, election denier. What is it? The new one, Christian nationalist. Yes, I'll take it all. That's all. That's me. But isolationist, is the term that, they call, people like me who don't want us to be spending all this money on all these foreign wars that see war as nothing but a racket, like Schmedley Butler says. And we're going to talk about the racketeers in this podcast. Take a listen to this clip and let's get started.
So Senator McConnell, the Republican leader, is stepping down from his leadership role next year, although he will serve out his full term. On Monday, he laid out his priorities in a local radio interview. Take a listen.
And
priorities. He laid out his priorities is what Jake Tapper says. Remember, we started the very first podcast that I did in this series of podcasts talking about Ukraine was a podcast that I titled Priorities because I told you that Ukraine is their priority. Not you, not your border. They're going to, Speaker Johnson's going to throw some border stuff in this bill to appease people to try to say, look, you know, we're securing our border and we're, you know, going to protect Ukraine, which is in our national interest. But you're supposed to secure our border. That's your job. No, don't try to appease us by throwing us, you know, some border security so you can send a bunch of money to Ukraine. The point is Ukraine is their priority. And that's what Jake Tapper says here, that Mitch McConnell in this radio program is laying out his priority.
Here is stepping down from his leadership role next year, although he will serve out his full term. On Monday, he laid out his priorities in a local radio interview. Take a listen.
And I'm particularly involved in actually fighting back against the isolationist movement in my own party. And so
this is a priority of his to fight back against the isolationist movement in his party. Is Mitch McConnell, this is what he wants to do with his last days in the Senate. Okay.
And I'm particularly involved in actually fighting back against the isolationist movement in my own party and some in the other as well. And the symbol of that lately is, are we going to help Ukraine or not? And I think it's extremely important that we do that. So I've got this sort of on my mind for the next couple of years is something I'm going to focus on.
But you heard Marjorie Taylor Greene insult Speaker Johnson yeah. by comparing him to McConnell and Nancy Pelosi.
Times have changed. Yeah, everybody has a gun to their head. It's like the end of Reservoir Dogs, I guess. Yeah. But what I'll notice this is, I think in the Trump era, it didn't so much change things dramatically as it accelerated things that were already happening. I think we saw the isolation.
Ron Paul started it. Ron Paul started listening. He's going to say here.
Earrings versus the more neoconservative wing.
Here, listen.
Yeah. But what I'll notice this is, I think in the Trump era, it didn't so much change things dramatically as it accelerated things that were already happening. I think we saw the isolationist Earrings versus the more neoconservative wing has really been bubbling for the last 20 years, ever since Iraq really ended. We saw it bubble up with Rand Paul in Syria in 2013. But I think this is the first time where there's been extended, long debate on this. And I would actually even say the isolationist kind of, or we can call it that, overtook.
Yeah, we took it over.
A lot of the rest of the party is in a real way.
Yeah, we took it over. We definitely took it over. And Mitch McConnell says that over the next couple of years, that's his job is to fight against us, the isolationists who don't want all of our money going to these wars overseas, who see our national debt as a significant issue that needs to be addressed. $34 trillion in debt. I mean, it's just insane. The effect that's having on the inflation and everything. Yes, we're done. Yes, the isolationists have taken over the Republican Party and we're done. And that's the problem going on here. Before we get back into some of the history that we were talking about in the last podcast, I just wanted to play Vivek Ramaswamy. He says something very poignant here. Take a listen.
If you're a CEO and you're looking to invest behind a project that you like, but it doesn't work out, things have gone sideways. Say you've allocated $100 million to a given project at a Fortune 500 company and it's totally failed. Maybe it's designing a new car. Maybe it's designing a new technology. Maybe it's building a new refrigerator, whatever it is. You've allocated money to that project and it has failed abysmally. And the people who are running that project come to you and say, you need to put another $100 million further in. Here's the first question you ought to ask them. What will the next $100 million accomplish that the first $100 million didn't? If you don't have a good answer to that question, you have no business throwing good money after bad.
Why? Why are we sending another? What? And I played the clip when we played the clips of Mitt Romney, even Mitt Romney, who believes that we should send this money to Ukraine. He also agreed with what's his name, J.D. Vance, that said this money's not going to do anything. This money's not going to help Ukraine win. So like Vivek Ramaswamy is saying here, I mean, what the first $100 billion that we sent over there, war's been going on for 2 years. What are the fruits from that? What are the fruits? We were in Afghanistan for 20 years. The Taliban is in charge right now. What are the fruits? Is what Vivek Ramaswamy is saying. What are the fruits from that? And if you can't justify the and say that you can show that this first $100 billion that we sent over there achieved something, then why would we send another $60 billion there?
Well, it'd be a good thing if our government officials behaved the same way. That's what the issue now in this debate, should be a debate at least, although we're not having it, about whether we should indeed send more money to Ukraine. Except this time, we're not talking about the $100 million number. That's a lot of money. We're talking about the $100 billion number. And here's the question that every Republican, and of course every Democrat also, ought to answer. What will the next $100 billion do for us, the United States of America in Ukraine, that the first $100 billion didn't already accomplish?
The answer to that question is push us closer to World War III, Vivek. That's push us closer and closer to a conflict that we cannot get out of. And by that time, it will be too late. That's the answer to your question, Vivek Ramaswamy. So back in the last podcast, we were looking at the Eisenhower farewell address that he gave in 1961, just 3 days before John F. Kennedy is sworn in. And the part of this speech that over the years that has gotten the most attention is when he gives this dire warning about the military-industrial complex. And he says, here, I have it queued up. Let's listen.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
So the military-industrial complex, what's that term all about? So the term industry, it goes back to the early part of the 20th century when we were in the industrial revolution, where industry was popping up all over this country, all kinds of industries, the fruit industry, the gas industry, the electricity and power industry. After the phone came about, the phone and communication industry. The railroad was an industry. This was a time when America made everything. This was before we offshored all of our manufacturing and everything was made in China. We made things here in the United States. We had an industrialized economy. And one of these manufacturers and industries was the armaments industries. We made weapons. There is a show on HBO called The Gilded Age. And The Gilded Age, we'll talk about what The Gilded Age is here in a moment, but I want you to take a little clip of a trailer from this show, The Gilded Age, on HBO. It's set in the city of New York. And it's set in this period of industrialization in the early 1920s is this period of time. And, it's all about high society in New York. And, what you need to understand, and I've said this to you before, but you need to understand is that this country is run from New York City, not from Washington, D.C. The United States of America is run from New York City, and the people who work in Washington, D.C. work for the people in New York City. And this has been the case for at least going back to the late 19th century, early 20th century, and definitely so today, that New York City runs this country. And the people who work in Washington work for the people in New York. Take a look at this trailer from the show, The Gilded Age.
New York is a collection of villages. The old have been in charge since before the revolution, until the new people invaded.
Well, I'm new. I've only just arrived.
You are my niece, and you belong to old New York.
What's she talking about, old New York? This is true to this day. This is why there's a clip. I don't have it set up, and it's about Trump. And Trump is at the Republican National Committee in New Orleans, and he's being interviewed by Larry King, and Larry King asked him if he's a Republican, if he's a Rockefeller Republican. Rockefeller Republican is a very specific type of Republican, because the Rockefeller Republicans became the neocons. So Larry King asked Trump if he's a Rockefeller Republican. He says, no, you know, I don't really get along with those type. I'm more of a person of the people that, you know, the taxi cab drivers identify with. You know, I build things is what he says. But no, I'm not one of those Rockefeller Republicans. This character right here, he is a railroad baron in the show, and he and his family play a very significant part, because in the show and in reality of this time, this is before the airlines, before things moved in the air and by truck all over the country. Back in this time, everything moved on trains. People moved on trains, goods moved on trains. So if you owned the railroads, then you made a lot of money. That's why, if you look at the, where do I have that? The Monopoly board. This is what the game Monopoly is about. This is the game of Monopoly is about these people. That's what it's about. The entire game. You notice the luxury tax, the most expensive properties. It's not Washington, D.C. It's over here in Park Avenue, in Broadway, New York. These are the most expensive properties. That's why you have the railroads. That's why you have the electricity companies. These are industries. Water. That's what this game is about. So the railroad barons, they made a lot of money in this period, and they had a lot of influence.
Before long, he'll put money into his pocket with every train ticket you buy. I think we should know the Russell family.
We do not move in the same circles.
Mama, you are incorrigible.
I take that as the highest praise.
Well, how do you find your aunts?
Data is kind, but...
So, Mr. Russell is the railroad baron, and like he just said, we put money in his pocket.
George Russell is a power in the land. Before long, he'll put money into his pocket with every train ticket you buy. I think George Russell is a power.
You put money in his pocket with every train ticket you buy. Okay, so this guy in this show is a model of many railroad barons. Not many, but there were a handful of railroad barons that owned and controlled the railroads that were very, very rich. And one of those men was Averell Harriman's father, E.H. Harriman. So E.H. Harriman was from New York, and that's where Averell Harriman grew up, in New York, and he grew up the son of a rich railroad baron. The term Gilded Age, let's read a little bit of this Wikipedia page. The term Gilded Age comes from a Mark Twain book, and it says, in the United States history, Gilded Age is roughly the period about 1870s to the late 1890s. So this is the end of the 19th century. This is after the Civil War. So the period after the Civil War to the end of the century. and this is the period of Reconstruction. This is when industry is starting to take root in the United States. And a lot of this industry was starting during the Civil War, because a lot of the weapons and things that were used in the Civil War to support the Union Army, you know, that laid the groundwork for peacetime, these industries, you know, developing to be used domestically for expanding the United States of America. So this period is 1870s to the late 1890s, which occurred between the Reconstruction era and the Progressive era. And in the 1920s, the historians started to use the term Gilded Age, comes from the Mark Twain book, but in the 1920s, the historians started using the term Gilded Age to categorize this period of time. If you've ever seen the Great Gatsby or read the book The Great Gatsby, it's about the later part of this time. And it says here, the novel by historian, so the name came from the 1873 Mark Twain novel by historians in the 1920s, who saw the interval of economic expansion as an era of materialistic excesses combined with political corruption. Okay, so this is the period of time, 1870s to 1890s. 1891 is when Averill Harriman is born. He's born in 1891. So he's born to a railroad baron, a rich railroad baron in New York, and he's born right after this period of the Gilded Age, this period of huge economic excesses, materialism. You know, it. I'm just trying to make you understand who this guy is. So let's read a little bit about Averill Harriman. So Averill Harriman was a American Democratic, so he was part of the Democratic Party, American Democratic politician. You're going to see here in a moment, this Democratic Republican stuff, it don't matter to these guys. They can care less. He was a businessman, a diplomat. He founded Brown Brothers Harriman Co. He served as Secretary of Commerce under President Harry Truman. He was the 48th governor of New York. So he was governor of New York for a period of time, as well as candidate for the Democratic Party nomination in 1852 and 1856. So he's running for the nomination in those two elections to replace Dwight Eisenhower. This decade of the 50s, starting in 52, is very important to everything I'm going to tell you today, because this is when these guys really do take control of government, and they're running everything in the Eisenhower administration. That's why I was telling you in the last podcast, when Eisenhower says, you know, we need to guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, where the sought or unsought by the military industrial complex. What I'm telling you is that industry had already taken over. Industry had already taken over the councils of government in his administration. John Foster Dulles, his brother, Alan Dulles, running CIA. Industry had already taken over. The influence of New York had already taken over the Eisenhower administration. So he runs for, Averill Harriman's running for president to replace Eisenhower in 1950. He doesn't get the nomination either of those years. Throughout his career, he was a key foreign policy advisor to Democratic presidents. So throughout his career, he advised Democratic presidents on foreign policy. Again, he was born to a wealthy, he was born the son of a wealthy railroad baron, E.H. Harriman. So he comes from a money with a silver spoon in his mouth, you know, raised in high society in New York. He went to the Gordon School and then Yale University. He was at Yale University at the same time as Prescott Bush, the father of George H.W. Bush and the grandfather of George W. Bush. So he was at Yale at the same time as them. So what fraternity do you think that he was in at Yale? Let's come on down here. It says right here, he attended Gordon School in Massachusetts before going to Yale University, where he joined Skull and Bones. So he was a member of Skull and Bones with George H.W. Bush and Herbert Walker. Okay. He made contacts at Yale University. He made contacts that led to the creation of the banking firm that eventually merged into Brown Brothers Harriman Co. He owned part of various other companies, including Union Pacific Railroad, Merchant Shipping Corporation, Polaroid Corporation. During the president of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harriman served as the National Recovery Administration and on the Business Advisory Council before moving into foreign policy roles. After helping to coordinate the lead lease program, Harriman served as the ambassador to the Soviet Union. What's the lead lease program? Lead lease program, formerly known lead lease program. Was under the United States, supplied the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union, France, China, allied nations in the Second World War with food and materials. Okay. So this was, that's what I thought this was. This was during the Second World War where we provided these materials, food, oil, to all of these places, the United Kingdom, Soviet Union, France. So we were aiding them in the war. So it says here, after helping to coordinate the lead lease program, Harriman served as the ambassador to the Soviet Union and attended the major World War II conference. So the World War II conference, and I don't have a picture there, but... and then it says, after the war, he became a prominent advocate of George A. Keating's policy of containment. So after, so let me just say this. So come down here. Let me show you the period of time that he was the ambassador to the Soviet Union. So right here, you can see. Says he was ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1943 to 1946. So when does World War II end? World War II ends in 1945. So for the last 2 years of World War II, and then that year after the war had already ended, he was the ambassador to the Soviet Union. Okay, so he was there for the last 2 years of the war in Russia. And there's a lot of people who say that that he was helping to command the Russian forces in those last years as Russia was moving into Berlin. So who is this guy? and this policy of containment. Where is that at? Oh, George Kennan, this guy, and the policy of containment. So it says George Forrest Kennan was an American diplomat and historian. He was best known as an advocate of the policy of containment of Soviet expansion during the Cold War. So containment is what the Cold War was all about. I mean, containment is what gave the CIA cause to stage all these coups and to do everything that they were doing because the policy of containment, the policy of containment, even when the United States Congress didn't support, a policy of containment and a example that I'm thinking of is Nicaragua, where, you know, that Congress had stopped the support to the Contras that were fighting the communist Sandinistas. And even though Congress had stopped that, then the CIA continued to support them under the table, behind our backs. And so the CIA had a very strong, they supported the policy of containment even more than Congress at times. Let me just say that. So containment is what it was all about. So it says he lectured, we're talking about Kennan here. He lectured widely and wrote scholarly histories of the relations between the USSR and the United States. He was also one of the group of foreign policy elders known as the Wise Men. And the Wise Men, they used to have their own Wikipedia page. I mean, they've scrubbed this. They don't even tell you that Averell Harriman was one of the Wise Men on his Wikipedia page anymore. I fully know that Wikipedia is not completely accurate. I just use it to kind of give an overview. But yeah, Averell Harriman was one of the Wise Men, and I don't have time to tell you who they were. But Kennan advised them. He created the policy of containment, which Averell Harriman, he supported, and the Wise Men supported, because of course Kennan was advising them. So the policy of containment is what all of this conflict with Russia and the Cold War was about while they were the USSR. And again, Russia is not the USSR anymore. Industrialists. So I said that, and it says on that Wikipedia page that Averell Harriman was born the son of a wealthy railroad baron. Well, another term that came about in this period of time was the not baron, but the term robber baron, that these industrialists, they're not just running industry, that they are corrupt. They're creating monopolies. They're getting rich off the backs of people. They don't care about people. Here, let's read a little bit about robber baron. Robber baron is a term that first applied as social criticism by the 19th century muckrakers, journalists, and others to certain wealth, power, and unethical 19th century American businessmen. The term appeared in that use as early as August 1870, same period of time as the Gilded Age. So the Gilded Age is the period of the robber barons. Okay? The Gilded Age is the period of the robber barons. The term appeared that use early in August 1870 issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. By the late 19th century, the term was typically applied to businessmen who use exploitive practices to amass their wealths. Those practices include unfettered consumption and destruction of natural resources, influencing We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military industrial complex. We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the whether sought or unsought by the military industrial complex, influencing high level. So these are the practices that were associated with robber barons. Those practices include unfeathered consumption and destruction of natural resources, influencing high levels of government, wage, salary, squashing competition by acquiring their competitors. God, man, think about what they did to the media in this country. Only, I mean, when Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act and deregulated media, this is what they did right here, squashing competition by acquiring their competitors. That's why only five companies own 90% of the media, because they started gobbling up. That was they did that on purpose, because, I mean, you can't have an honest media and have robber barons. Because if you have an honest media, so the people who are calling them robber barons are the muckrakers. The muckrakers were reform-minded journalists. You got to get rid of the muckrakers if you want to have robber barons. So that's what they did to the media, squashing competition by acquiring their competitors. And they could only do that after Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in the 1990s to create monopolies or trust that controlled market schemes to sell stock, inflated prices. So these are all the things. The robber barons only cared about money. It's the only thing they cared about. And that's and Eisenhower is here talking about the military industrial complex, but he should have been worried about all industry. All of these guys that were taking over in his administration, they were taking over. They were running. They were representing industry. Your Secretary of State, who worked for Sullivan and Cromwell while he was your Secretary of State. His brother, who was the CIA director, who also worked for Sullivan and Cromwell while he was the director of CIA. They were working for industry. Yes, the military industry, but all industry. The fruit industry, the gas industry, the railroad industry. That's what these guys were doing in your administration, Eisenhower. So, let's go back here. Averill Harriman. So Averill Harriman started Brown Brothers Harriman, and Prescott Bush, let's go back here, the father of George W. Bush, George H. W. Bush, and the grandfather of George W. Bush, and Jeb Bush. So Prescott Bush. Look at when he's born. So he's born 4 years after Averill Harriman. So Averill Harriman is 4 years older than Prescott Bush. Prescott Bush was from Connecticut. Show you a map here. So this is Connecticut right here. This is New York. Connecticut is basically just a suburb of New York. This is New York. This is Connecticut. That's where... This is where George H.W. Bush was born. This is where George W. Bush was born. I think it's hilarious that the Bushes, particularly George W. Bush, act like he's Texan. He acts like he's a cowboy. Karl Rove's the one who, when George W. Bush was governor of Texas, he lived in the governor's mansion. He didn't have a house, and he... After he was getting ready to run for president, Karl Rove is the one who told him to buy that ranch in Crawford. This guy's not a rancher. So he buys this ranch in Crawford. You never see him on a horse. You never see him doing anything but taking this. When the press would come out, he'd be out there cutting brush with a chainsaw. One of my favorite stories about George W. Bush comes from Vicente Fox, who was the president of Mexico at the same time that George W. Bush was the president of the United States. And Vicente Fox, now Mexicans are real cowboys. I mean, the word cowboy comes from caballero. It comes from Mexican cowboys. They're the ones who would rodeo, ride horses, push cattle. Going back to the Spanish conquistadors, they were real cowboys. So this is who Vicente Fox was. And he had on his property horses. And he tells this story about how George Bush comes down to Mexico and he takes him to a stable and he presents his prize stud to George Bush, and this huge, beautiful horse comes out, and he gives this, loud neigh, and Vicente Fox said that he watched George Bush jump back. Ah! And he was scared. And then that's why Vicente Fox, he started calling him all cattle, or all hat and no cattle. That's what he said. That this isn't a real cowboy. He's from Connecticut. He's from Connecticut. He's not from Texas. His father's from Connecticut. He's blue blood. And then he comes down to Texas and he pretends to be a cowboy. That's what these people do. So Prescott Bush, born just a 4 years after Averell Harriman, but they were at Yale at the same time, and they were both skull and bones. And then Prescott becomes the senator from Connecticut, and he's there. Look at this time period, very significant time period from 1952. 52 is when Eisenhower is elected, and he's there for that entire very important decade. And in the Senate, who do you think this guy represents? You think he was representing the people? Or was he representing industry? Was he representing industry? Now, Averell Harriman was a Democrat. But look at what it says right here. Prescott Bush was an American banker and a Republican. American banker? What bank did he work for? He worked for Brown Brother Harriman. The same bank that his fraternity brother and his friend Averell Harriman started, who happens to be a Democrat. I mean, usually friends that are this close, who are fraternity brothers, who work for the same bank, they usually have the same politics. But Averell was a Democrat, and his boy Prescott was a Republican. And then this guy was also at Yale at the same time, which I think is interesting because Herbert Walker he's like 15 years older than Averell Harriman, 20 years older than Prescott. 1875 is when he's born. 1875. Now, if you know the story about Herbert Walker and Prescott at Yale, and I think they stole the skull of Geronimo and brought it back to the crypt there at Yale, that Prescott and Herbert Walker were like best buddies there at Yale. But it looks like Herbert Walker is 20 years older than Prescott. 1875, Prescott born in 1895. So 20 years older this guy is. And he has such an effect on Prescott that Prescott names his son George Herbert Walker Bush is named after George Herbert Walker. So he names his son after this guy. And he also worked for Brown Brothers Harriman. He was there with Averell Harriman at Yale, and they all worked together at Brown Brothers Harriman. Now, about Brown Brothers Harriman, look at this Guardian article. How Bush's grandfather helped Hitler's rise to power. This is in the Guardian. How much time do I have? Dang, I only have 10 more minutes. Man, I haven't even scratched the surface. people. George W. Bush's father, grandfather, George H.W. Bush's father, worked for Brown Brothers Harriman. How Bush's grandfather helped Hitler's rise to power. George Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, senator from Connecticut, friends with Averell Harriman, went to the same fraternity as Averell Harriman, friends with Herbert Walker Bush, these guys who are representing industries. George Bush's grandfather and the late U.S. Senator Prescott Bush was director and shareholder for companies that profited from their involvement with the financial backers of Nazi Germany. But they don't tell. It's funny when you read this article. I mean, they should come out right here and give you the name of the bank that he was in charge. You have to go down and do, you know, some digging to find out which the name of the bank is. And the name of the bank is Brown Brothers Harriman. It's the name of the bank that was trading with the Nazis. The Guardian article here says the Guardian has obtained a confirmation from newly discovered files in U.S. National Archives that the firm of which Prescott Bush was director was involved in the financial architects of Nazism. His business dealings, which continue until the company's assets were seized in 1940. So they continue. They were working with the Nazis up until 1942. Anybody who knows anything about World War II knows that that the Nazis were on the march. The war was well on in 1942. They had already invaded Poland, and so much had happened by 1942, and Brown Brothers Harriman were still, it says, his business dealings, which continued until the company's assets were seized. And the only reason they stopped doing business with the Nazis is because their assets were seized in 1942 under the Trading with the Enemies Act. So Brown Brothers Harriman, Averell Harriman's firm, these guys were working with the Nazis, not only working with the Nazis, they helped the rise of the Nazis. And they're all representing the big business, the big barons of industry, all industry. That's what the coup d'etats were for in the 1950s. It was all about business and industry to create their monopolies and to, to loot, to prey on American people and make money. Not only American people, people of the world. This was George W. Bush when he was president. This was a white tie event that he gives in New York. I want you to listen to what he says.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
The haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base. Yes, the Republican Party has come a long way. It's made a lot of changes. We're full of isolationists now. Yes, we're isolationists. Yes. I'll take it. I'm an isolationist. Yes, this guy is no longer welcome in the Republican Party. These Rockefeller Republicans, this is what the debate and the struggle is between this new branch of the Republican Party that are isolationists, that are debt hawks, that are real conservatives. We're different from these people. We're different from these people. And all these people now are supporting Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. The people like Liz Cheney, people like, I can just start naming them. We know who they are, the war hawks, the neocons, the Rockefeller Republican. Some of them, like Nikki Haley, I mean, she's not a Rockefeller Republican, but they line her pockets. That's the game. They find people that maybe have come from humble beginnings, that are ambitious. And that's why I say that the people in Washington work for the people in New York, because that's their game. They find these people that, again, are born in humble beginnings, that are poor, that are ambitious, and they get them, and they wield power through them. That's what happened with Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon doesn't come from New York. He didn't come from the robber baron elite of industry. Like, look what it says right here. It says, Richard Nixon was born to a poor family of Quakers in a small town in Southern California. Richard Nixon was born into a poor family of Quakers in a small town in Southern California. It's a lot different than this. It's a lot different than what George Bush was born in, and Prescott Bush and Averill Harriman. That's a lot different. It's a lot different than being born the son of a wealthy railroad robber baron. It's a lot different. Says Richard Nixon was born into a poor family of Quakers in a small southern in a small town in Southern California. Humble beginnings. That's where Richard Milhouse Nixon came from. So who tapped him to be the face of the industry, the face of the movement? We're going to listen to a little bit of Russ Baker here, and then we're going to pick this up again on Monday. Russ Baker is the author of the book Family Secrets, and he wrote this book about the Bush family and their legacy, and it's called Family Secrets. Let's listen to Russ Baker.
What the father was also doing was he was moving up in politics, and he was moving up very rapidly in the Richard Nixon administration. This is one of the most astounding ascents ever seen. Several interesting things happened. Right after Richard Nixon took office, he arranged a date for his daughter Tricia with George W. Bush and sent a plane paid for by the taxpayers to pick W. up. This is a story that's not terribly well known. But all of these things happened. Poppy Bush, with almost no experience, first-term congressman, he gets on the short list of nominees to be the vice president of the United States with Nixon. Now, why would you put him on the ticket? He wasn't a particularly good speaker. He didn't have a really strong constituency anywhere. He was not well-established or well-known. And yet they put him on the ticket. Then after that, he runs for U.S. Senate. He loses. Nixon names him ambassador to the United Nations. And again, he knew nothing about this. One of his friends asked him, what do you know about this? And he smiled and said, ask me in 2 weeks. After that, 2 years later, at the height of Watergate, they made him the chairman of the Republican Party. Now, you think about this. This is an unusual ascent, to say the least. I wondered what that was about, and that, again, took me another, you know, 6 months of research and down another rabbit's hole. And what I discovered was, just as I had not properly understood the Kennedy assassination, and I might mention, by the way, I had always assumed that Lee Harvey Oswald had been the lone gunman. I really didn't pay any attention to it. Frankly, most journalists know it's a quagmire, and it's just not something, if you want to keep your career on track, that you want to get into. And that goes along with flying saucers. And so I never looked into that. But once I just started discovering the footprints of certain people associated with the intelligence community and associated with George H.W. Bush, I did have a reason, and that was the result was those four chapters. On the Nixon thing, was the same thing. I had always assumed that Nixon was the bad guy in Watergate. It was just excesses, and that was it. What I discovered again was that we didn't understand our history. And the way I found out about this was I started seeing Poppy Bush's fingerprints on the Watergate story. What I discovered was that the Watergate burglary was not the signature event of this period. It was one of a series of covert operations that look, when you look at them carefully, to have been deliberately bungled. And they were all deliberately bungled in such a shocking way that really you would have to say that these were carefully thought out about how you could bungle this in such a way as to embarrass Richard M. Nixon. And so this forced me to completely see it in a different light. I've got several chapters on this in trying to understand why Richard Nixon would have even favored the Bushes in the first place. I went all the way back and I discovered, much to my astonishment, that the Bush family appears to have played a role in the creation of Richard Nixon. And again, this is not in any of the Richard Nixon biographies. That back in the 1940s, when Richard Nixon first ran for office, Prescott Bush, the grandfather, who was a senator and very, very close with Wall Street interests, was out in Whittier, and they were looking for a candidate to run against the Democrat there, Jerry Voorhees, but not because, as people said, because Jerry Voorhees was a liberal. The reason they apparently wanted somebody to run against him was because Jerry Voorhees was worried about Wall Street. Does this sound familiar? He was afraid, you know, after the Great Depression, that maybe we needed some more regulation. Maybe the maybe Wall Street was out of control. Maybe it was lacked transparency, and it needed more regulation and more oversight. And so Jerry Voorhees was the leading person for oversight of Wall Street and banking, and they took him out with Richard M. Nixon. And so Richard M. Nixon, as best as I'm able to ascertain, was beholden to the Bush family, and this is why he gave them all of these appointments. But once he got in office, he seems to have decided, you know, I'm the president now. The president can do what he wants, and I'm not going to let these people tell me what to do anymore. And I describe in great detail here all of the things he did that angered the oil industry, things he did that angered the military-industrial complex, things he did that angered big companies of all different types, that angered the CIA. And
they took him out.
You start examining all these people, you start finding them all connected to Poppy Bush and all having their own intelligence connections, including the man who discovered and told the Senate committee about the taping system.
All right. So we will get back into this in the next podcast. I have so much, like I said, I didn't even scratch the surface today, but we're talking about Russia today. I'm going to tell you what is going on with Russia today. And the people that are causing this conflict with Russia today, it's many of the same people. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I will see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.